Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is here. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We actually have a good martini today. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. Let's start with the good, and this is from the pages of the New York Times. She was a rising Democratic star. She was the first in her party to be elected state attorney general. She was one of the most powerful women in Pennsylvania. But on Monday night, Kathleen G. Kane, the state's top prosecutor, became a convicted criminal. A jury found Ms. Kane, 50, guilty of 9 criminal charges, including perjury and criminal conspiracy, convicting her of leaking grand jury information and then lying about it in an effort to discredit a political rival. Ms. Kane was caught up in a web of scandal and counter-scandal, threaded with lewd emails, political rivalries, and alleged leaks. It has cost other state officials, including 2 state Supreme Court justices, their jobs, and Ms. Kane her law license, although she has remained on the job as attorney general. Ms. Kane stared straight ahead as the word guilty, uttered decisively by a juror in a flowered dress, echoed 9 times around the courtroom. So, Jim, Kathleen Kane was supposed to be challenging Pat Toomey this year. These allegations cost her the chance to make that race, and hopefully Pat Toomey will still be able to win his race. But Kathleen Kane went from the darling of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania to someone who is now a 9-time convicted criminal, and the liberal Democratic governor of the state, Tom Wolf, is insisting she resign, which we have to think she'll probably do fairly soon. But it's good to see that at least one Democratic crook is facing justice.
It is, and it's a Democratic crook who was endorsed by the Clintons. I know that'll surprise you. You could probably make the argument of, perjury, abusing office, series of lies. She really is a Clinton at heart, so you can understand the attraction. There are 2 aspects that really jump out at me. One is that, look, for Bill Clinton, everybody who endorsed her, I mean, this, she proved time and again through her behavior and her response to the allegations, the response to the accusations, she orchestrated this series of leaks about all of her rivals. She was, in terms of moral character, the exact opposite of what you want in a law enforcement position. She was, it sounds like this abuse of power pretty much started as soon as she got in there. And so you want to talk about just somebody who could not be trusted with power. Then the next thing, kind of the cherry on top of this whole thing, you alluded to this, Greg, that she was, charged with these crimes about a year ago, and the state Supreme Court revoked her law license. Now, this means she is unable to take part in any of the legal aspects of her job as state attorney general, Greg. Which I think would pretty much be every part of the job. I really was trying to rack my brain. What does a state attorney general do that doesn't involve the law?
Apparently sending a lot of backstabbing, corrupt emails.
There's that. You get in the office and send emails all day. Sorry, taxpayers of Pennsylvania. But then I think, is there like ceremonial ribbon cutting or something? what is she doing all day? And the fact that she didn't resign in either of those circumstances. One is, that she fought these charges and pretty obviously she was guilty. I don't think anyone is that surprised by the conclusion. She was guilty on all charges. This is by no indication this is prosecutorial overreach. No indication this is a vendetta against her. And she's just there. You point out that as of this taping, she has not resigned. This is the Democratic governor called for her to resign. He called for her to step down a year ago. You want to talk about somebody who's like, you're going to have to drag her out of her office, with her fingernails scraping the floor. But maybe it's hard to do that when you're in handcuffs, huh, Greg?
I guess so. I mean, Democrats are always far more reluctant to resign, but usually once they've been criminally convicted, that tends to be the benchmark. I have to assume if she doesn't go, she's going to be impeached rather quickly. So we'll see if she wises up here. I don't know if she's facing actual prison time here, what the punishment for these 9 criminal convictions is, but that would make your job even harder to do. No law license, and you're in the pokey.
Can I send that file to her? It's only going to be a paper file, none of those iron files.
That's right. From Pennsylvania, we go to the bad news right here in Virginia. And Jim led off the morning jolt with this here on Tuesday. You haven't heard much about Virginia in this year's presidential race, he writes. This is a state Obama won twice by 6 percentage points in 2008 and 4 points in 2012, and that Republicans had won in the previous 8 presidential elections. It's still a state that the right Republican can win. Bob McDonnell and Republicans swept the statewide offices in 2009, and Ed Gillespie came within a point of knocking off Mark Warner in the 2014 Senate race. Yet this morning, the Washington Post survey finds Hillary Clinton with a 52-38% lead among registered voters. Trump is running about 10 points behind Mitt Romney. He trails by 7 if you factor in Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. But, Jim, the fact here is troubling on a couple of fronts. First of all, Virginia used to be rock-solid Republican almost regardless of the nominee. I mean, Bob Dole easily beat Bill Clinton here in 1996, for example. But now with Virginia trending blue, Northern Virginia especially, with the infusion and the growth of government, this cycle is going to be potentially rough for a lot of Republicans down ballot. And it's also kind of a wasted cycle because as the state gets bluer, Virginia's going to be harder and harder going forward for Republicans to win.
Yeah, and look, you could probably make the argument this is, by almost any definition, heading into this cycle was a purple state. It is a state where Republicans don't have a big margin for error. But, you know, Greg, you and I are old enough. In 2009, Bob McDonnell swept this state by a huge margin.
Right.
You might say some of this reflects the weakness of Cree Deeds, but came right after Obama's 6-point victory in 2008. And this was a state where being biased, living in Northern Virginia, I may focus on it of greater interest to me than people nationally. But if you want to win the state of Virginia, if you're a Republican, you got to do at least reasonably well in the northern suburbs. You don't have to win them, but you got to keep it close. And for perspective, McDonnell won Fairfax County, where I live. It's got a million voters there. Ken Cuccinelli, the state attorney general candidate that year, came just under 50%, so he almost won it here. And then even last year, Ed Gillespie got 40%, but he did well enough in the rest of the state to be about 1 percentage point behind Mark Warner, an incumbent Democratic senator who was going to be pretty tough to beat. So it's possible for a Republican to win this state. You just got to not miss a lot of shots, so to speak. Well, we don't have specific results for Fairfax County, but the Post poll indicates in Northern Virginia region that Trump is at 23%.
Ooh.
You can't win. You cannot win if you're at 23% in the Northern Virginia suburbs. And I have not seen a great deal of yard signs or offices. I understand right before the primary, they opened an office in Old Town Alexandria. But by and large, there's very little indication that the Trump campaign is making much of an effort in Virginia. And this is a state that you would have guessed going into this cycle, a Republican would be making a major effort to win. And that there was room for a Republican to win this. And they're just conceding it. You can kind of throw Colorado in that category. Another poll out today had him down 14 there. Like, these are purple states that the Trump campaign basically has, at this point, it appears no shot of winning, which gives you a much narrower path. You got to pick off a state like Pennsylvania, and it's just not looking good. And it just seems like the bad news for Republicans keeps piling up. I don't know if this makes any of the House Republicans in Virginia vulnerable, but, you know, this is a candidate who just is not competing in a lot of places that a Republican needs to compete.
Yeah, a couple different thoughts here. First of all, Jim, he does have a plan in Virginia. He's had some rallies here. So just because he doesn't have any organizational ground campaign or spending any money on advertising, he's having a rally here or there, and that's the big plan, as he pointed out earlier. So just remember that that's going to be his successful ticket to the 13 Virginia electoral votes. Secondly, I think the only congressional race that might be difficult would be Barbara Comstock. It all depends on the quality of her challenger, but that's usually the most competitive House race in Virginia. But I think the biggest point is the one you make. It's already a tough road for a Republican to get to 270 in the Electoral College. I mean, George W. Bush barely got there twice, and Virginia was locked in for him. There wasn't even much of a campaign here.
He won by 8 points both times.
Yeah. So,
not much of a swing state back then.
Exactly. So as you say, when you lose those 13 electoral votes, you got to find them somewhere else. And there aren't many hospitable states to do that, that the Republicans haven't already been successful in. So way to go, Trump. Way to go. Why do they factor in, do it separately between the two and with the third party candidates? Do we think that Gary Johnson and Jill Stein are just going to suddenly not run or that we can't trust how many people will actually vote for them?
Well, I guess the thinking is that as Election Day gets closer, you generally see a certain number of voters drift away from the third party options. People want to vote for, they want their vote to be meaningful. If they see their candidate languishing behind in the single digits, they may gravitate towards that. I your point, though, stands that, at this point, Hillary's ahead with 4 candidates in the race. She's ahead with 2 candidates in the race. And it's a little bit closer with 4 candidates, but just not looking that great. Probably just out of curiosity of whether the third-party candidates are hurting one candidate or the other. And the interesting thing is that I don't think you'd say, oh, Gary Johnson is costing Trump this. In fact, there's a decent number of support that seems to drift away from Hillary in these scenarios.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because the Gary Johnson posits himself as being more progressive on social issues longer than Hillary has, which is true. Won't help him among the conservatives that he's trying to win also. But that is one way that he's drawing over some people from Hillary, who is extremely unpopular, as well as Trump. And here's another reason why, as we move to our crazy martini. This is courtesy of Larry O'Connor over at Hot Air. She isn't even president, and Hillary Clinton is already mimicking President Obama's brilliant ability to surrender and telegraph our lack of will to fight to our enemies and allies. Clinton told a crowd in Scranton, PA yesterday that the idea of American troops in Iraq to combat ISIS is, quote, off the table as far as she is concerned. The quote from the Washington Post, quote, Donald Trump has been all over the place on ISIS. He's talked about letting Syria become a free zone for ISIS, a major country in the Middle East that could launch attacks against us and others. He's talked about sending ground troops, American ground troops. Well, that is off the table as far as I'm concerned, unquote. And then Larry says, setting aside the fact that there are already over 3,800 troops in Iraq, many of them fighting on the ground to defeat ISIS, is it really a wise policy to telegraph to our enemy exactly what we won't consider doing in our efforts to defeat them? So we kind of said this after Hillary Clinton's references to ISIS in her convention speech, Jim. If you're looking for a different strategy to defeat radical Islam, to defeat ISIS in a Hillary Clinton administration than what we've got in the last several years from this president, you're out of luck.
Two thoughts in response to this, Greg. First being that the airbrushing away out of history of those 3,000 troops or so, there really seems to be this mentality in the Obama administration, and every indication is that Hillary will change this, is that we'll send troops to a war zone. We're just not going to act like we're at war. And we're just not going to – it's like Fawlty Towers. Don't bring up the war. And if we do that, the public will feel calm, and they'll feel like things against ISIS are under control. The problem's not that bad. It's just another routine peacekeeping mission. We have guys out there fighting these guys. And every once in a while, we've had a couple casualties with long-range bombing or things like that. There was that joint mission with the Kurds a little while ago. I'm glad they're doing this. But I kind of feel like the country, if we're at war, we should be on a war footing. And it really feels like this philosophy of this White House of, look, we're going to downplay it. We're going to be quiet about it. This is, look, everybody just, this is not that big a deal. Let's talk about healthcare again. Aetna just left. No, quick, let's talk about something different. There really seemed to be this is a White House that wants to believe this is not a wartime election, that we are not at war, and that the problem of ISIS is just, it could something be contained, never mind the fact that, ISIS refuses to believe in peace. It refuses to believe in coexistence. It believes it is destined to take over the world. You can't contain something like that. It's just going to get worse. The second thing where she says we would never, that is off the table. Greg, can you imagine a scenario where we feel the need to send additional ground troops against ISIS?
Sure.
I mean, we'd hope it doesn't come to that. But, ISIS has made very clear after Orlando, after San Bernardino, after other things, they want to Paris, Brussels, they want to commit more terrorist attacks against Western targets. So God forbid. But, if they set off a giant truck bomb somewhere, they blow up buildings, it's not, I can think of ISIS doing something really terrible, in which there's a widespread sense in America of, okay, very much the feeling after 9/11, we got to go get these guys. We cannot continue to think, some routine bombing will be enough to take care of it. And I hope it doesn't come to that. But on the other hand, it does kind of feel like we are in this state of a gathering threat, or at least a persistent threat. You've heard some people arguing that the success in bombing against ISIS is actually driving them to focus more on attacks by sleeper cells and groups against Western targets. There's about 8 months before 9/11, the USS Cole got bombed. And they're kind of this sense of like, well, if you don't think about the problem that bad, we won't have to deal with it. Well, one day, it's very conceivable, we will have to deal with it by sending ground troops. And I don't understand the value of a presidential candidate saying, no, we're totally not going to do this. This is one way of responding to the threat that we're completely not going to do it. I get the exhaustion with the Iraq war, but I don't understand how you can see much of a scenario in which ISIS just goes away by itself. And we've been waiting forever for our allies in the region to take a larger role. We've been bombing them rather incessantly. And ISIS is still there. And yes, we've, eliminated some of these guys. But it just seems very hard to see Hillary Clinton as anything less than a continuation of the status quo against ISIS. And it's very hard to believe that's considered an effective policy that's going to resolve this threat to the United States anytime soon.
No, not at all. Part of me thinks it's a sop to the Bernie voters, but I'm not even sure she's really trying to win them anymore because she probably doesn't think she needs them at this point. But probably resonates fairly well with them, though.
Yeah, I mean, just a kind of an odd sense of, look, don't worry, I'm not going to be like George W. Bush. Nobody wants to go to war. Nobody wants to send ground troops. But the question is, you know, if the threat gets bad enough, it might be necessary. And maybe it won't. Maybe ISIS is going to, you know, eventually wither away. But at this point, the signs don't look good for that. And it just feels a little bit like, wasn't Woodrow Wilson's reelection, he kept us out of war?
Yes.
And then he promptly got us into the war?
Yes.
Why would you run around saying there's absolutely no chance this could happen when, in fact, there's a chance? Oh, it's because they're Clintons. Okay, that explains it. Bring us full circle on our three martinis.
Yes, exactly. Another Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, by the way. Jim, have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.